From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. It's Art and Craft Day at TT Book. No, we're not gluing macaroni to cardboard. From the halls of London's great Victoria and Albert Museum, to the Bits and Atoms Lab at MIT, from a forge on the coast of Maine, to a one-man concrete park in northern Wisconsin, we're looking at what we make, what we call it, and how it's shaping our lives. Where it is, from sauerkraut to glass beads to bow ties, we're going through a new makers movement here in America. Two radio producers set out to collect stories about making. Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson are the Kitchen Sisters. Their latest project is called The Making Of. Here's how it got started.
I think with our work, we're always trying to look at what brings people together and what is that creative spark and spirit. And there was a call for new stories and new projects, stories within 100 miles of where we live. And we started thinking about making and creativity and innovation and a kind of handmadeness that was sort of defining our region.
Is it, do you think that it's homemade that is the key to this? Is that what makes a community?
Not necessarily homemade. I think it's that energy that comes with ideas and innovation, and it's not just about things. I think that was something we found out pretty quickly with this whole project, that the things were important, but really it was kind of the community that was built around doing things like this, either in the family or the neighborhood or the larger community. I feel like those kinds of things where people are really putting their mind towards something that they have a passion for, whether it's making a jar of jam or, building a 3D printer, it all kind of comes from that same urge to create and to share that creation with others.
It's pretty exciting, as a matter of fact, the wide variety of responses you got to your plea. Actually, it would be fun to stop for a second and listen to that call you put out.
That'd be great.
We live in a time when fewer and fewer people know how to make the things they want or use or need, or how these things are made.
My grandmother began sewing in the 20s. My mother was the costume designer at Diablo Valley College. And my sister and I work for Simplicity Pattern Company. We, as a family of women who sew, carry a great deal of pride with it.
I am making the ninth wonder of the world.
We're searching for stories of artists, inventors, community visionaries, immigrant communities, traditions, and new technologies.
It's a really nice way to put the question. At the beginning of that, you're talking, though, about the maker movement. Is there really something called the maker movement? Nikki?
Yes, definitely. We're sitting in the midst of it. I think that was one of the things, too, that propelled the project. There's the huge maker fair here that began in San Mateo and the Silicon Valley. And every place you look, really, there's a place we just did a story about. Actually, we're working on it now, called Tech Shop, where they're sort of bringing together old school tools and lathes and woodworking tools with computers. And they've got these, these geeky guys working with these really old fashioned guys, creating this much larger, much more looking towards the future community. It's happening in so many different directions, not just tech wise, but also the food movement and, artisan cheeses and back to the land kinds of things. So yes, definitely, there is a makers movement.
So do you think that it is a desire to make on the part of the people who are in this, or is it more that we don't want to just buy things off the shelf? Do I have to make something myself to be happy about it?
No, I think there's a certain pleasure and sort of aesthetic satisfaction when you see something that someone has actually handmade and that you haven't seen in 10 other shops. And to have someone's heart and soul in the object, I think, is a real lure for people.
Some of these things, I think, people have begun to run into no matter where they live around the country. Maybe food is a place to start with that. And I was struck by one of the stories, the kimchi story.
Over in West Oakland is a little hidden restaurant called The Fuse Box. And Sunyi Chang is from Korea, grew up on Guam, and his passion is kimchi.
Kimchi is fermented cabbage, chili peppers, salted pickled shrimp. It's alive. Each day that it goes, the flavors change. When I started making kimchi, my mom kind of giggled. Nah, the kimchi is made by women. Yeah. Men weren't really allowed to be around. There was a time when the women would gather from the villages. There would be matchmaking. You know, there would be some marriages that came about during the time of kimchi making. I was always told that if the men started hanging around and touching the kimchi, it would be bad kimchi. But I so miss my mom's kimchi, I just had to make my own. When I eat that, the memories just flood.
One thing I love about the Fuse Box when we went to interview Sunyi, this place is just exploding with makers. Right behind the Fuse Box is this place where they're making perfume. And they have this little hillbilly still that you can actually go out on walks and you'll go through the Big Sur area and smell all the smells and gather plants. And they'll make a perfume of your walk right there, right after your walk through the brush.
There's another one that I'd like to listen to, and then we'll carry on. It's not just about crafts, is it? There's a piece you did with Notch. What does he make?
Notch makes hot rods and tiki bars.
Let's listen.
When I was working on brand new cars, I wasn't really happy. It was just like I was wasting my artistic time working on these new cars, and then 10 years, 20 years down the road, it's in a wrecking yard. When I work on these old cars, I know that they're being cherished. They have a family value. We're at my shop, it's Top Notch Customs. Notch, you know my name, Notch. This is my hot rod. It's a 1935 Ford pickup. It's got a Model A frame that's boxed and heavily Z'd in the rear and in the front. It's got a Merc flathead with Kong heads, Kong distributor, fixed in high-rise intake. It's chopped 7 inches in section 6, channeled in the front 5. I mean, it's really radical hot rod, all bare metal.
He loves those things, doesn't he?
He does. And the thing that just really struck me about Notch was this community that he had created. He lives in San Jose, and his whole neighborhood, there are all these garages and guys in their garages, and they kind of do this progressive party where they'll go and look at what each other's doing in each other's garages. And then the tiki bar thing is big. They built these tiki bars, so they have cocktails at the tiki bars. But it is such a community phenomena. It's really their way of socializing and sharing what they've created.
Well, and a lot of what seems to be going on is stealing our sense of who we are. This is a way of creating identity, isn't it?
And I think the thing for me is that it's on so many levels. Like, you don't have to be a scientist or a sophisticated inventor. But, I mean, it's the smallest acts. When we first put the word out, we asked, we said the making of the Bay Bridge, the making of a jar of jam. And, I never really thought anyone would call us about the making of a jar of jam because it just seems so everyday and so... so much like what so many people do. And we received this call from this woman. She said, I just heard the making of a jar of jam, and I had to tell you my story. And her story was really about her mother and how she'd sort of watched her mother all of her life, make things and make jam. And then when her mother died, she began paying attention to this tree in her yard where the plums were just dropping, and she could hear them at night. And she and her husband always felt guilty but never did a thing about it. And they began to make this jam. And suddenly she made more and more and more jars of jam, and that drew her to the Berkeley Crop Exchange, where people come and share and trade what they make. And it was just obviously so much bigger than a jar of jam and such a simple thing.
One of the things that you haven't said, and I'm glad of it, I guess, I have to say that up front, is this is the best hot rod you'll ever see. This is the best plum jam you will ever taste. That's not the point, is it?
Not at all. No, we'd be in big trouble if that was the point, because we're not the jury. But I think that for us, the real telling was how someone told their story in these phone messages and how they communicated what they were doing and why.
We always say our microphone is a stethoscope, listening to the complicated heart of the nation. And this time the stethoscope was on what people make. One of the stories that's still on the to-do list is the making of a baby. It's the ultimate maker's movement.
All of these stories are stories that people tell each other, and they have such personal elements to them. There was another one that you did about cars. Let's play it, and then you can comment on it afterward, if you would.
One babe, one bag, going to SFO. I will give it to the driver, and they'll be there in about 10 minutes.
I was having a hair appointment. I was getting my hair blown out at Dina's Glamorama. My friend said, Lenny Breedlove has started Homobile. Call if you need a ride. And so I told them where I was and I needed a car. They said, I think it was Musty Chiffon. Yes, it was Musty Chiffon. She showed up and was my driver.
See what I tell you? Traffic. My name's Lenny Breedlove. I run Homobiles, a community ride service for the LGBTIQQLNOPQRST community and its allies in San Francisco. You do not have to be a big fat queer to get a ride from Homobiles, but it does help. No, just kidding. But, you know, you need to understand that the real reason that we are here is for people that don't get rides normally from anyone else. And so, if you're putting on all this padding, high heels, a wig, and three sets of false eyelashes, and a bunch of glitter, you are high priority at Homobiles.
I lost some of the letters in the middle of that, I have to say, but made me smile. You really left the definition of making loose, haven't you?
Yeah, well, the making of a solution in your community. Here was this group of people feeling discriminated against, feeling that they couldn't get rides, feeling if they did get rides, they were harassed. And what did they do? They made a Homobile. It's not just about the jar of jam. It's not just about the hot rod. It's not just about the pie. It's about people making a whole vision, making a project, making the community the way they want to live in it, but with imagination and humor and style.
Well, Davia, Nikki, the Kitchen Sisters, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was fun.
Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson are the Kitchen Sisters. If you're in the Bay Area, on May 30th or 31st, they're helping fill the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art with makers. Why not check them out? And if you're not on the West Coast, you can find links to more making stories on our website, ttbook.org. You know craft when you see it, right? Those unique felt hats at the holiday sale, the delicate porcelain bowls at the gallery store, the worn wooden jewelry box your grandfather made by hand. Crafts about the object, about the wool or the wood or clay from which it's made. It's about the tradition of the making. But there is more to it, says Glenn Adamson. He's head of research at London's Victoria and Albert Museum. Anne Strainchamp sat down to talk with him about the future, the past, and the philosophy of craft.
Well, Glenn, I want to start with the basics and talk a bit about what we mean when we use the label craft these days. Because I think, you know, you mention it to a lot of people, and if you say craft, they think you mean scrapbooking or knitting or cake decorating. But somebody else might think of fine furniture making or museum-quality Japanese vases.
Yes, I think the interesting thing about craft is that it is, in fact, all those things at once. So it covers a very, very wide range of human endeavor. So anytime you have skill and you have process and knowledge of materials, you have craft. So, for example, cake decorating might seem like a kind of amateur, marginal pursuit, whereas fine furniture, or indeed carving marble to make a sculpture, could be considered to be quite an elevated occupation. But then you can ask, why is that? Why don't we respect cake decorators as much as we respect sculptors? And it's that kind of ability to rethink existing hierarchies that I think makes it really attractive as a subject.
So is that what you do as a curator? You look for the absolute best examples of cake decorating or weaving or whatever, and then that's what goes in an exhibition that you're curating?
Yeah, it could be the absolute best example. At the V&A where I work, we had an exhibition called Power of Making a couple of years ago, and that was really about the most extraordinary skilled makers that you could find in these various areas. In fact, there was a sugar decoration specialist, but you can do it other ways too. You don't have to say who's the best. You could also say who's the most interesting, who's putting the most of their own personal story into it. I recently did a show about repair, for example, and that looked at repair of all different kinds, some of it very shoddy and fast, and therefore quite expressive, actually, and interesting to look at. And some of it so skilled that you could scarcely tell what had been done because the repair was so complete, so perfect, that it had erased itself.
Wow, that's just fascinating. Wait, tell me more about the things that were repaired.
Well, they come in all shapes and sizes. You know, there's a wonderful tradition in Japan where they'll take a broken tea bowl, and instead of making the crack invisible, they'll actually fill it with lacquer and then cover the lacquer with gold leaf. So it looks like the crack has actually been repaired with molten gold. And what they've done there is to draw attention to the accidental beauty of this cracked line.
Well, that's such an interesting example that you bring up, because it strikes me that one of the things that adds to the beauty of that particular object is that there's a powerful idea behind it. What matters more, the actual object or the idea that informs it?
I'm glad you asked that question. I think often craft is opposed to other forms of creativity that seem initially to be more conceptual. So you often have this opposition that's made between, let's say, tacit and bodily knowledge, which is something a craftsperson would have.
What do you mean?
Well, like knowing something in your hands, but in a way that you could scarcely explain. You know, everyone has that feeling of if they're good at something, whether it's a craft or playing a musical instrument or playing a sport, you have this feeling of being able to do something almost without being aware of doing it as you're doing it. It's kind of out-of-body experience that's also very intensely bodily at the same time. For that reason, craft has this reputation, I guess, of being unthinking or unconscious, let's say anti-intellectual. But the way I think about it is that craft is actually a way of showing your commitment to an idea. So let's say you have that idea about the broken pot being a kind of accidental, beautiful object in its own right, and you want to draw attention to that. You do that by filling it with lacquer and then painstakingly putting that gold leaf there as a way of almost doing tribute to the idea, as I say, showing a kind of care and commitment to the idea.
So if you go way back in Western history, there were guilds and master craftsmen, you know, so like a gorgeous silver salt cellar made by a 17th century master might have been prized by, owned by kings. And then somewhere along the way, as you were saying, you know, craft came to be considered second rate, kind of like fine art's poor cousin. What happened?
Yeah. For me, it really happens in the, let's say, late 18th, early 19th century when you have the Industrial Revolution. And suddenly there's another way to make things. You know, you don't have to make them by hand. And until you have industry, you don't really have craft in the way that we talk about it. And that's really where this idea of it being inferior comes along. And so from that point on, craft is sort of fighting to prove its value.
So are you talking about the period when William Morris and some of the other artists, craftspeople, and also political activists in England came together and created the arts and crafts movement?
Yes, I think that's really the next part of the story. Craft, since it has emerged as this thing that seems threatened, seems older, seems valuable, that's when you have these people like William Morris who emerge as part of what we call the arts and crafts movement to try to save these crafts and also to revive them in cases where they seem to have disappeared already. But at the same time, I feel like looking back, there's a degree of idealization there.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting. You pointed out the first crafts movement kind of came about in response to the Industrial Revolution. So I'm wondering about where craft is going right now. There does seem to be a hunger these days for artisanal products, and people want small batch vinegar and handmade chef's knives, and they also want to learn how to make things for themselves. So do you think something's changing about the way we think about craft?
Yes, I think that is an obvious thing to say, but I think important that the more time we spend online, the more maybe we want to go to a garage or to a studio and make something by hand. I think it's also important to say, though, that this can be a bit of a cliche. there's a lot of companies now that are producing artisanal makeup. And, you know, I even saw a car ad recently, where a brand was presenting it, its most recent SUV as being a completely handcrafted project. I look at that and just think, well, that just shows you how powerful it is. It has this reputation, craft does, for being marginal and being the kind of weaker cousin of industry. But in fact, it's something people run back to again and again.
Is there a way to bring these two different worlds together, manufacturing and handmade, crafted?
Yes, this is something I'm very interested in, and I think a lot of makers are today as well. There's a feeling that the opposition between craft and industry doesn't really make sense any longer because of the degree of bespoke making that new technologies are offering. There's a phrase that people often use, which is mass customization, where you have the economies of scale that mass production give you, and then you also have the specificity, the personalization that craft gives you. Think about a 3D object where every aspect of it can be customized so that your entire house, everything you live with, can be completely customized at any time. Or, you know, you walk down the street and every car that goes by you looks completely different from the one that came before it. And in fact, Audi is looking into this at the moment, where the company produces just the platform, so the guts of the car, what everything else rides on, and then all of the parts that you see, the body of the car, is completely customized and made in local shops.
So it wouldn't just be me designing my own car. I might have the local Picasso has designed my car.
Yeah, precisely. It's going to be a massively collaborative project to reshape our environment. If everybody pitches in, then you get this incredible result that speaks of both individual preoccupations and knowledge and also the sense of a kind of social responsibility, what we should all know. And ideally, that's the relationship we would have to our environment. And you're going to get that through a combination of craft and technology.
Oh, it just seems like it's going to be a wonderful new world for artists and craftspeople.
Yes, and I think the more freedom that we can grant artists and craftspeople and designers and technologists and inventors in that new set of possibilities, the better off we'll be. There needs to be a moment of, you know, letting a thousand flowers bloom and sort of not try to control the process too much and see what happens, because I think the results could be magical.
Spoken like a curator. Thank you.
Pleasure. Yeah, real pleasure.
Glenn Adamson's head of research at London's Victoria and Albert Museum. His latest book is called The Invention of Craft. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Thumb through a copy of Roadside America, that guide to the wild and wonderful world of America's tourist attractions. Some pretty good stuff in there. Beyond the pet cemeteries and the world's smallest this and the planet's biggest that, there's art out there. Whole countries worth of people who've transformed their houses or yards or some spot in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, some of those creations are pretty wacky, but over the past 50 years, some of them have caught the eye of the art crowd. One of the first people to advocate for so-called outsider artists was Ruth Kohler. She's the director of the John Michael Kohler Arts Center. It's just a couple of hours from our studios here in Madison. So producer Sarah Nix stopped in to talk with her.
Ruth Kohler says she got hooked on what she calls vernacular art in the 70s when a friend invited her up to northern Wisconsin to see the odd sculptures that Fred Smith was building on his property.
I met Fred right away, and he really changed my life. I was an artist and a teacher, so I saw a lot of art, contemporary art, historical things. Fred's work was different than anything I'd ever seen. It sometimes made me think a little bit of some of the early cathedrals in Spain and France. The cathedrals were seen as a whole masterpiece. I mean, they were a lifetime of work, and with Fred it was. He just decided that he had to make something, that it was in him to do something great.
What Fred did was take buckets of concrete and bones and bits of broken glass to build dozens of life-size figures. They're men and women, loggers, farmers, Native Americans, soldiers, horses, oxen, stags. They crowd around his house like a country fair that somehow magically turned to stone. Smith's family wasn't sure what to do with his creations, and though they look rough and simple, Ruth says she saw art in them.
This, like many of his works, has the concrete and then is embedded with shards of beer bottles from his bar. There are all kinds of people. Daniel Boone, Paul Bunyan. There's a man in a wagon. There is a double wedding. The bridegroom in the front is handing a bottle of beer to the bridegroom in the back. And so throughout, you see this kind of wit, but you also see the real documentation of the people around him, of the community, the love that he had for the people there. People today call them outsider artists often, and they're not. He was anything but an outsider artist. He portrayed Iwo Jima and Sun Yat-sen, as well as his neighbors and his friends.
Ruth and her colleagues saw that Fred Smith's world was worth preserving. They brought together local and state officials, the Art Center, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Kohler Foundation to save the site and the work. And it did not stop there. It turns out there are hundreds of people like Smith across the country, people who've built strange, marvelous environments. They've made their houses into living canvases, covered every surface with dowels or bottle caps or bits of broken glass. They've spent their lives reinventing their worlds. And Ruth Kohler's made her life's work saving theirs, even though at that point it wasn't what most people were calling art.
We believe that the symphonies and the theaters and the mainstream artists were extraordinarily important, but many people thought the arts weren't for them, that it wasn't a part of their lives, that it wouldn't be a part of their lives. And we felt that Fred Smith and artists like him would resonate. And it's not the kind of response that you sometimes get from people when they see something that's abstract or whatever, that they say, well, I could do that. This is in awe when they realize that this is somebody who was self-taught and made these extraordinary things. And so they feel that maybe, just maybe, they could make something wonderful themselves. We believe that their work is very different, but as powerful as the finest contemporary artists.
So far, the Kohler Art Center has preserved 27 artist-built environments, from New York to India to right here in Wisconsin. This year, work from two of those artists will travel to one of the greatest contemporary art events, the Venice Biennale.
Aren't they amazing?
Ruth opens a cabinet door and we see these compelling, intricate sculptures. They're rickety, pastel-painted towers that look like something out of a Russian fairy tale. The closer you get, the odder they seem. They're made entirely of tiny bones.
Chicken bone towers, glued together, then painted. Much of it is tiny, tiny necks, wishbones, and they go up to about 4 to 4.5 feet.
They're the work of Eugene von Brinchenheim, a Milwaukee man who created the fantastical out of anything he could get his hands on.
Okay, here you see a lot of crowns, all made out of clay. He had a potbelly stove that he heated the house with, and he fired them in that. And you can see on this shelf, tiny little flowers, just hand-built, petal by petal. He'd painted the walls in the same colors as his ceramic vessels and the crowns, everywhere, in the attic, in the basement. And he made brushes out of the hair of his wife. Isn't it incredible? He did thousands of photographs and hundreds of pots, and he did things well, no matter what he did.
The Art Center was not able to save the von Brinchenheim house, but the delicate collection is now safely tucked away in Sheboygan. From crowns, to pots, to poems, he was a prolific maker, even though he was broke.
And they lived on as I remember, it was about $2,000 a year. He didn't have the money to buy chicken, but he would go through the trash. He was also a bitter man to some extent. He applied to the National Endowment for the Arts for a fellowship, a grant, and didn't get it. And I think it hurt him very, very much.
And maybe that's why, when their work first started to get the attention of curators and gallerists, von Brunchenhain and makers like him got stuck with the label outsider artists. But outsider, vernacular, self-taught, high art, folk art, craft, all of those categories have elevated some people and excluded others. Von Brunchenhain, Fred Smith, and many of the other artists in the Kohler Collection didn't live to see their creation celebrated at the Biennale. But maybe now we can simply call their making what it is. And what it is art.
Ruth Kohler directs the John Michael Kohler Arts Center, which has the largest collection of complete vernacular art environments in the world. Try putting that in roadside America. And now that summer road trip season's heating up, why not send us your photos of wild and wonderful creations you come across? Try Facebook or Twitter. Our handle's @TTBook1. On the rocky coast of Maine, small wooden buildings tumble through the trees to the water. Inside the small studios, world-class artisans gather to blow glass, wheel clay, or pound metal. Welcome to Haystack Mountain School of Crafts, where people have been learning, sharing, and honing their skills for more than 50 years. In one studio, the pound of hammers and the hum of the potter's wheel give way to the zap of laser cutters and the whir of microprocessors. For the past few years, Haystack's been home to a high-tech digital fabrication lab. It's part of a network of labs that MIT has set up around the globe, from Afghanistan to Chile to Kenya. Steve Paulson asked Haystack director Stuart Kestenbaum and MIT's Neil Gershenfeld to talk about the lab as a space for art. Here's Gershenfeld.
I direct the Center for Bits and Atoms at MIT. It's a program that works at the boundary of physical science and computer science. So one of our fundamental projects is how to make a Star Trek replicator.
Wait, how to make a Star Trek replicator?
Right. In Star Trek, there was this wonderful box where you could come up to it and ask for anything, and it would assemble from the atoms on up, and out would come the thing you want. And so in turn to do the research, we have a suite of tools. And that led to an outreach project to let ordinary people get access to the tools. That led to a global network of community labs, which in turn led to the wonderful collaboration with Haystack on how all this technology meets art and craft.
Okay. Stuart, what do you do?
I'm director of the Haystack Mountain School of Crafts, and it's an intensive studio-based program. And we work with people from all around the country and abroad, working in craft media from glass blowing, blacksmithing, jewelry, papermaking. And the school is 62 years old this year, but increasingly over the last 10 or so years, we began to look at craft and making and creativity kind of in a broader perspective. And that's where our involvement with MIT began and led to our having a fab lab.
Well, it would seem like you two do very different things. I mean, Neil, you are in the high-tech game, and Stuart, you are working with old-time craftspeople, traditional kinds of things. How did the two of you come together?
First, I'd say that understates it at the origins. When we first set up these tools at Haystack, which is one of my favorite places on Earth, it was analogous to when Dylan went electric at the Newport Folk Festival.
That extreme.
There was a riot.
Well, I think actually we need to step back for a moment then. So, Stuart, tell me about what was happening in your studios at Haystack before you ever started working with MIT, and in what kinds of projects were your craftspeople doing?
Well, I think, you know, over time, how people work with materials is always evolving. Haystack was started as part of an interest in using the hand in a kind of post-World War II environment. So we have a whole range of ways that craft materials are used, but it's not traditional handcrafts where it's passed down from generation to generation. And Neil, I think, opened up a way that we could look at how we were looking at making things.
Mm-hmm. So Neil, why did you want to go to Haystack? Why did you want to work with this, in some ways, this very traditional setup?
Sure. So to answer that, I think we have to go back in two historical steps. The first historical step is to understand the word digital. If you look at manufacturing, in 1952, MIT made the first computer-controlled milling machine. The computer's digital, but the manufacturing's not. You just smush material around. And that's still the case today. Advanced 3D printing or integrated circuits, the materials don't contain information. So the research to the Star Trek replicator is how to put codes and programs into materials to code their construction. That's where the research is going.
Okay.
The equivalent to the PC for digital fabrication doesn't exist yet. That's the replicator that doesn't just make a piece of plastic, it makes a complete functional thing. That's still many years of research away. Then there's fab labs. Today, for about, maybe $50,000 in equipment, you can buy a suite of tools that let you do what the replicator will be able to do. This is far beyond just a 3D printer you may have heard a lot about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Stuart, let me turn to you. So why did you want to have access to all of this high-tech stuff?
Well, in 2002, we had a conference with MIT, with the Media Lab. And we had one project where we had Tom Joyce, who's a MacArthur Award-winning blacksmith, was working with Justine Cassell, who was then at MIT. Their project was to make a vessel that would tell the story of its own making. So they had sensors in it that would show where a rivet had been done or a forge weld, and that would display itself alongside the vessel. And they were working late at night, and blacksmithing seems like an archetype of the oldest technology you can have, with a very primitive fire. And then right next to our people who were doing that were doctoral students from MIT working on their laptops, and there was the red glow from the fire and the blue light from the computers. And I thought, well, they're both fires. They deserve to be together.
This is so fascinating because, I mean, there's this old traditional belief, I think, that those old handmade crafts, metalworking, glass blowing, are the antidote to our overly mechanized culture. That, I mean, a lot of people have sort of gravitate to those because they don't want to have anything to do with what seems to be the industrial manufacturing that's taken over our society.
Right.
Are you saying that attitude's a mistake?
I think that it's more about time and place and materials. It's a tool among all the tools we have. And I think what it always reminds us is that you want to use the appropriate tool for the job. If a pair of scissors is the right answer, then you use the pair of scissors and not the laser cutter. You can't do what a glass master like Lino Tagliapietra can do with his hands in the fab lab, but you can find things that, when it's appropriate, can complement it. And there's no fear that we're going to not have the acoustic guitar and the electric guitar. We'll have everything and just know when you need to play what.
Hmm. So I can see how the makers at Haystack would be learning all kinds of new things. Does it work the other way too? I mean, do the MIT computer people learn something from the artisans at Haystack?
We really do. The way it played out was, if you go into the lab, there's many ways you can produce input. You can draw on a computer screen. You could take a photograph. You can 3D scan. And then there are all these machines. And the problem when we got set up there was each person who came in the door broke something in our workflows. They might want to take ink on paper and sandblast glass with it, or take topography and turn that into leather. Each person had a different combination of inputs and outputs that they wanted to transform. And so out of desperation, we started a project there. The artists are so demanding but articulate that they push us to refine the tools. Initially, we'd been buying commercial software for engineering, design, and manufacturing. We began to write our own to keep up with this demand. And then the surprising thing is the software we were developing because of the challenges at Haystack is now largely what we're using on campus. And so this morning I was working with the team doing laser micromachining for microfluidics for genome transfer in cells using modules from the software we wrote for Haystack.
Stuart, what have been some of the most exciting objects that have come out of your fab lab at Haystack?
Well, I think this idea of being able to transfer image and change scale has been an important one. We had a sculptor, Richard Notkin, who was teaching for us. He lives in Montana, does beautiful, very small press molded sculptures. And we were able to scan that and make his work 10 times the size that it was. And I think just for him to be able to see that change in process and the change in scale was amazing. There are lots of smaller applications that people see when they come in. If each Fab Lab has its own kind of identity, Haystack brings a particular sensuous relationship to materials. And a thing that's important about it too is that it's done in a community. So there's a lot of dialogue. That to me is very exciting to see every time it happens.
So that's a big part of what I value. It may sound funny, but I don't like do it yourself because doing it by yourself makes it hard to mentor and progress from easy to hard. And so Haystack is a wonderful place of mentoring to master and progress. I view this as correcting a very old mistake. The liberal arts emerged in the Renaissance, and at that moment, the illiberal arts, making stuff, separated. That's when art and artisan separated. And we've been living with that split for a few centuries. What this is doing is sort of bringing the means of production back to the individual, so you don't have to distinguish between art and artisans, and you can see 3D machining or microcontroller programming as every bit as expressive as traditional means. So there's a new style of a person emerging who's a designer. They design 2D, 3D, hardware, software. They just design stuff, and you can't neatly separate it. You know, are they an artist? Are they an artisan? Are they an engineer? The answer is yes.
That's Steve talking with Neil Gershenfeld, the director of MIT's Center for Bits and Atoms, and Stuart Kestenbaum, director of Haystack Mountain School of Crafts. If you want to see some of the work that's come out of Haystack's Fab Lab, stop by our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Now, we're going to take a left turn from straight-up art and craft to spend some time with this man.
I hated the raw oppression of being a kid once I became self-aware. I don't like alpha people as a rule, and in the random enclosed societies of schools, you have to deal with them. I didn't like being stuck with strangers, period, either. I also didn't like being told what to do, and of course, school and childhood itself is about the authority of all grown-ups. I knew as well as any of them what was worthwhile, but because I was a kid and they were bigger and had more power than me, I was cheated.
It's Richard Hell reading from his memoir, I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp. When he co-founded the band Television in the mid-70s, he also created a look and a sound that would eventually be called punk. Steve Paulson asked Hell to start with a reading from his book.
I remember making some promises to my adult self when I was still a kid, or extracting some promises from my adult self. I promised not to forget how arbitrary and unfair adult rules are. I promised to remain true to the principles I grasped that adults sometimes pretended to know, but hardly ever behaved in accordance with. I wanted to have a life of adventure. I didn't want anybody telling me what to do. I knew this was the most important thing, and that all would be lost if I pretended otherwise like grown-ups did. Those monstrous box-like, snouted, yolk-colored school buses with their rotten black lettering symbolized loneliness and humiliation. The weather they rolled through was gray and rainy, and I gazed out the window, hoping not to be noticed, except by a particular girl.
Oh, that is a great passage. Thank you. And you know what I find so striking about your memoir is how you stayed true to that vision. I mean, you created a life for yourself that challenged all kinds of authority figures, all kinds of social rules. But I have to say, you must have been a handful for your parents.
Yeah, you know, in retrospect, I kind of feel sorry for my mom. Even though, you know, on the scale of delinquency, mine was pretty minor.
You know, one thing that's striking is, as I was reading about yourself as a teenager, as far as I could tell, you really didn't play music then. I mean, considering, you know, you made your name later on as a seminal figure of the punk movement, but, I mean, you weren't in garage bands. Was music a big part of your life when you were growing up?
No, not any more than for anybody else. You know, but it was a great period for music. I think that was important because, I mean, once I did start a band, it was partly out of frustration with the horrible stuff that was on the radio at that time later. In the mid-60s, it was, the music was really the kind of teenage news, you know. It was about real life and, you know, it says things to you about what the world was like that you weren't hearing anywhere else. Those early Electric Dylan stuff or crazy Rolling Stone stuff like Paint It Black or Who's Driving My Plane, you know, the music of the band sort of showed you a wider world.
Yeah. Well, you have a great passage where you reflect on the rock music of your time and especially what it means to be a rock and roll star. Could you read that?
I remember rainy weather with the Aftermath LP by the Rolling Stones playing in someone's room off the common area in my dormitory. Stupid Girl, Under My Thumb, I Am Waiting. The record was so ragged and tinselly and expert and full of personality, cavernous and wise ass. I didn't buy into the mythology of rock and roll bands, though. As I said, the music was just a common feature of the environment. I wasn't a fan. The style of some of the groups was exciting, but the musicians were people who had taken a chance direction into music. I still prefer that angle on it, the way it is when a band starts out. Half the beauty of rock and roll is that anyone can do it, in the sense that it's not about being a virtuoso, but about just being plugged in a certain way, just having an innocent instinct and a lot of luck.
Hmm. So there you were, a rebellious kid. You didn't fit in 1966. You just dropped out of high school, moved to New York. What were you looking for?
Well, I was looking for, you know, an arena. I was an aspiring poet. And New York was the center of the world for every kind of doing things well, period.
You hooked up with your old high school friend, Tom Miller, who later changed his name to Tom Verlaine. What was the connection between the two of you?
I guess what we had in common was a kind of sense of humor, sort of perverse and Martian, and an interest in art, writing, music, especially sort of obsessed, compulsive kind of art making.
Why did you change your name from Richard Myers to Richard Hell?
Well, I've had a few names. There are others, too. But Hell came from when I was first starting a band with Tom. And a lot of what was exciting to me about switching to rock and roll was how that rock and roll had all these means of communication apart from simply the writing and performing of songs, that there was a whole complex package. For instance, hair. I mean, hair's been really important in rock and roll from the beginning.
And you had very distinctive hair. You had that spiky hair.
And your name and your clothes and the way you behaved on stage and what your interviews were like and what the album cover looked like, what the posters looked like.
So there was a whole style that you were, it sounds like you were trying to create. And you had your ripped clothes, the safety pins, as well as the, you know, the spiky hair. What were you trying to communicate?
Well, you know, just the same way that my writing tried to express what was going on inside me and my perceptions of the world, I wanted all those other media, all those other means to do the same. It was about, you know, putting your insides on the outside.
So you and Tom Verlaine started your own punk band, which soon morphed.
It wasn't a punk band.
Well, later.
They weren't calling bands punk when we started.
Well, then it became the band known as Television.
Yeah, and you'd get a lot of arguments from people about whether or not Television was a punk band. But when I was in the group at the very beginning, it was a lot more like what people ended up calling punk. And the kind of attention that we got was about those qualities for sure.
How would you describe that? I mean, what were those qualities? And we're talking early 1970s, especially the music around the club, CBGB in Lower Manhattan. What was that was happening there?
What was different about us and about many of the bands that then started centering around CBGBs was that it was spare, cut down, fast, short songs that were often angry, but also with this lyrical feel to them too, were about real life, you know, returning real life to rock and roll, the kind of real life that was in it when I was a kid, defying authority by speaking the truth to it.
You have a great passage in your memoir about the power you felt creating music and kind of about this whole scene we've been talking about. Could you read that?
The power and beauty of it was unimaginable until then. It can't be overstated, that initial rush of realizing, of experiencing what's possible as you're standing there in the rehearsal room with your guitars and the mics turned on. And when you make a move, this physical information comes pouring out and you can do or say anything with it. It was like having magic powers, the ability to create action at a distance. The sounds that came from the amplifiers were absurdly moving and strange, the variety of them so wide in view of the fact that they came from flicks of our fingers and from our vocal noises, and the way that it was a single thing, an entity, that was produced by the simultaneous reactive interplay of the four band members combining various of their faculties. We were turned into a sound, a flow of sound. It was like being born. It was everything one wants from so-called God, the joy of it, the instant inherent awareness that you could go anywhere you wanted with it, and everywhere was fascinatingly new and ridiculously effective. It was like making emotion and thought physical to be undergone apart from oneself. And every moment had that surging astonishment and pleasure, even if in the service of anger and disgust, as it often was, of anything being possible to make happen. It was like creating the world, and the feeling could never quite happen again, or be sustained anyway, because familiarity and habit take the edge off.
Steve Paulson talking with Richard Hell, one of the co-founders of the band Television, one of the progenitors of punk. His memoir is called I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Art and Craft. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with the help of Doug Gordon, Ann Strain Champs, and Charles Monroe Kane, with audio ingenuity by Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.